Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour tonight, challenging the mandates. The Supreme Court hears arguments on whether the federal government can require vaccinations for healthcare workers and large employers. Then, chaos in Kazakhstan. The country's leader vows to quash unrest as violent protests erupt against the government's authoritarian policies.
You have to understand what has happened here. The coiled spring has now been unleashed after 30 years.
And it's Friday. David Brooks and Jonathan Capehart weigh in on the way forward after the nation remembers the January 6th assault on the Capitol. All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. The U.S. Supreme Court today heard lengthy arguments challenging the Biden administration's vaccine and testing requirements in the workplace. The high-stakes cases could have significant implications for some 100 million workers. John Yang has the story.
Judy, the two rules being challenged are at the heart of the Biden administration's pandemic response. One would require big employers to make sure that their workers are either vaccinated or tested at least once a week. The other requires vaccinations for healthcare workers at facilities that treat Medicare and Medicaid patients. As with all things surrounding the pandemic and vaccines these days, these rules are sparking strong opinions. We asked viewers for some of theirs.
My name is Robert. I'm 27 years old, and I work in public programming at a local museum here in Miami, Florida. As of October 1st of last year, my workplace required that all staff be fully vaccinated.
My name is Kayla Alexander. I'm 26 years old. Currently, I'm a nurse extern at a hospital.
I'm Tommy Redwood, but I'm an MD, board certified emergency physician, and have been for the past 30 years. When the mandates came out, it was get the vaccine or face termination of privileges. I have certain concerns about the safety of the vaccines and the efficacy of the vaccines. And for this reason, I elected not to get the vaccine. I was terminated.
My name is Rebecca Lawson. I am 35 years old. I am from Spokane County, Washington. In Washington State, Governor Inslee did put out a mandate for vaccine for particular sectors of employment. At the time that the mandate was put into effect, I was pregnant. And when I got my first shot to keep my employment, it was a situation where I had wanted to get it on my own terms. But to keep my employment, I needed to get it on the timeline that was required by the state.
My hospital job mandated the implementation of having the vaccine. We've lost more housekeeping staff, if anything, with declining the vaccine. So it's more so a time issue. In terms of the burden being left on people who are not in traditionally housekeeping roles, such as myself or a nurse.
I fully support the mandate from OSHA, and I hope it passes. My hope is that it can help level out some of the discrepancies between the federal response and the state responses to the pandemic. As someone who has loved ones and family in places like California and New Hampshire, living here in Florida, I think it's a shame that the response has been so uneven.
I think my feelings on a federal mandate for vaccination is that it is the responsibility of a person, their family, and their community to make the best decisions for them. It is a deeply personal decision, and fear is a very powerful motivator.
Being terminated after devoting my entire professional career to this community, coupled with the fact that just 1 year earlier, we were being touted as heroes. At the end of the evening, you would hear the horns honking and people, you know, celebrating the things that we were doing. And to go from that to saying, okay, we appreciate your service, you were a hero, but now if you don't do what we tell you to do, we're going to terminate you, we don't need you anymore. That felt like a form of betrayal from the system.
But I do think that since people have made it very clear that it is their right to have the vaccine, they need to understand clearly it is a company's right to not employ you if they want you to be vaccinated.
Technically, today's arguments were not about whether the vaccine mandates are legal. They were about whether the mandate should take effect while they're being challenged in lower courts. Marcia Coyle is chief Washington correspondent for the National Law Journal. Marcia, divergent views from our viewers, and we heard some divergent views from the justices today during their oral arguments. So let's start by playing some of that. The first up is Chief Justice John Roberts questioning Elizabeth Preloger, who is the Biden administration's attorney.
It seems to me that it's that the government is trying to work across the waterfront, and it's just going agency by agency.
What we're trying to do here and what OSHA did was rely on its express statutory authority to provide protection to America's workforce from grave dangers like this one.
It seems to me that the more and more mandates that pop up in different agencies, it's fair. I wonder if it's not fair for us to look at the court as a general exercise of power by the federal government and then ask the questions of, well, why isn't Congress have a say in this, and why doesn't this be the primary responsibility of the states?
All kinds of judgments on the public health side, on the economic side, how those two things ought to be balanced against each other. So who decides? Should it be the agency full of expert policymakers and completely politically accountable through the president? Or on the other hand, courts can decide. Courts are not politically accountable. Courts have not been elected. Courts have no epidemiological expertise. Why in the world would courts decide this question?
Congress and states and governors wielding emergency power are the ones that have the power, and we acknowledge that, over vaccines. The idea that OSHA would be the agency in the federal government that's not even under the Department of Health and Human Services, that does not have expertise over communicable diseases like the FDA or CDC maybe, that would just be a very odd place for Congress to lodge such a sweeping power over the American people.
Justice Elena Kagan questioning Scott Keller, who represented the trade groups opposing the OSHA rule. Marcia, what's the significance of what we just heard?
Well, John, I think the bottom line is there is a very deep divide on the court on how it's looking at the vaccine mandates and the authority of the federal agencies that are trying to implement them, whether they have that authority. The Chief Justice was increasingly skeptical as the arguments went on and was wondering if he pointed out several times that, okay, there's a workplace mandate. There's the Medicaid, Medicare mandate. There's the federal contractor mandate. And he said, well, you know, really, this looks like it's almost an attempt to work around the limits of authority of the executive branch. And that concern about how broad some of the agencies are using their authority was echoed by other justices, such as Justice Neil Gorsuch and Justice Amy Coney Barrett. They wondered, you know, where are the limits on agency authority? That is something that conservatives in particular on the court have been concerned about for many years. On the other hand, you have someone like Justice Kagan who's basically saying, this is really how government works. Congress delegates a certain amount of authority to federal agencies in order to make decisions, rules, regulations based on their special expertise that a Congress cannot have every time an issue comes up that has to be addressed by the national government. And so she is saying, you know, who would you rather make this decision, the courts or the agency with the expertise? And her view also was echoed in a different way by Justices Breyer and Sotomayor. Justice Breyer in particular is sort of the reigning pragmatist on the Roberts Court. And he's very concerned about the consequences of delaying the mandates. And he gave the statistics that we are all seeing now and reading now about the number of infections, the number of hospitalizations. And he worried that each day of delay would cause more deaths, more burdens on the hospitals trying to deal with the growing number of infections. So there is just really a deep divide. It's not to say that the justices on the left are not also concerned that the agencies exercise the proper authority here, but they're seeing it through a different lens.
was there the same divide, the same skepticism from the conservative justices when it came to the healthcare worker vaccine mandate?
Not so much, John. In fact, the arguments were somewhat muted, and I don't know if it was because the justices were exhausted after 2 hours of arguments on the workplace mandate. But I think they saw, and the Chief Justice did point this out, that there seemed to be a much tighter fit between the vaccine mandate for healthcare workers and the statutes that govern the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services and the Department of Health and Human Services, which are charged with being responsible for the health and safety of the patients in those facilities. So I think that mandate is going to have an easier road when the justices sit down. And as you pointed out, this was not really an argument on the merits of the mandates. They're looking at whether injunctions should be issued to delay these mandates. And when they do that, they have a whole series of factors that they look at. And one of the factors is, of course, the likelihood of success on the merits of a challenge to the mandate. Also the weighing of, you know, the public interest. What are the equities here on each side? And what is more important, public health, or as some of the states have demonstrated, there could be some serious consequences from the mandates in terms of job losses. It's not the easiest decision for some of them. In fact, Justice Alito pointed out at one point that this raises complex issues, and maybe even though the states want an immediate halt to these mandates, maybe the court should have what they call an administrative stay to give them a couple of days at least to think it through. I'm not sure what the court is going to do at this point, but I have a feeling that they will act fairly quickly.
Marcia Coyle of the National Law Journal, thank you very much.
My pleasure, John.
In the day's other news, the number of children under five who are hospitalized in the U.S. and test positive for COVID is still rising sharply. The CDC reports the figure has hit pandemic highs as overall infections top 600,000 a day. President Biden offered an optimistic assessment today after former advisors urged new strategies for, quote, the new normal.
Having COVID in the environment here and in the world is probably here to stay. But COVID, as we're dealing with it now, is not here to stay. The new normal doesn't have to be. We have so many more tools we're developing and continuing to develop that can contain COVID and other strains of COVID.
Also today, the FDA cut the wait time for getting Moderna's booster shot after the initial two doses to 5 months instead of six. U.S. unemployment rate is now at its lowest since the pandemic began. The Labor Department today reported the rate dipped to 3.9% in December. That was down from 4.2% in November and far below the pandemic peak of nearly 15%. At the same time, employers reported a net gain of 199,000 jobs. That's well short of expectations. Three white men convicted of chasing and murdering Ahmaud Arbery in Georgia were sentenced today to life in prison. Father and son, Greg and Travis McMichael, who initiated the chase, got life without parole. William Roddy Bryan took video of the confrontation. He will have a chance at parole. In court, Arbery's mother said they killed her son for being black and jogging in their neighborhood.
They chose to target my son because they didn't want him in their community. They chose to treat him differently than other people who frequently visited their community. And when they couldn't sufficiently scare him or intimidate him, they killed him.
Defense attorneys have said they plan to appeal the convictions. In Michigan, a judge refused today to lower the bond penalty for the parents of a teenager who allegedly killed four students at his high school. James and Jennifer Crumbly are charged with involuntary manslaughter for giving their son a gun and failing to intervene after seeing his violent drawings. They are now each being held on a $500,000 bond. A winter storm has dropped more than a foot of snow across the Northeast. Plows in Boston labored to keep up today, and New Jersey declared an emergency. Skiers glided through New York Central Park, but public schools stayed open. Hundreds of other school districts did close. The storm broke snowfall records in the South on Thursday. Meanwhile, on the West Coast, heavy rain caused severe flooding today near Chehalis, Washington. The water closed a 20-mile stretch of Interstate 5. And President Biden got a firsthand look today at wildfire damage near Denver and Boulder, Colorado. He met with people affected by last week's fire that destroyed nearly 1,100 buildings, most of them homes. Some 35,000 people were forced to flee. On Wall Street today, stocks drifted lower again. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 4 points to close at 36,231. The Nasdaq fell 145 points and was down 4.5% for the week, the most since February. The S&P 500 slipped 19 points today. And two passings of note tonight. Groundbreaking actor Sidney Poitier has died in Los Angeles at the age of 94. We'll look at his life and work later in the program. And Harvard Law professor Lonnie Guinier passed away in Boston. In 1993, President Clinton chose her to lead civil rights enforcement at the Justice Department. He withdrew the nomination after Republicans attacked her views. Lonnie Guinier was 71 years old. Still to come on the NewsHour, our correspondents share memories of the day the U.S. Capitol was attacked and reflect on the time since. David Brooks and Jonathan Capehart on vaccine mandates and the messages of January 6th. How the late Sidney Poitier paved the way for other black actors and much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
Today, Kazakhstan's president promised to shoot to kill protesters after a week of demonstrations. Kazakhstan lies at the strategic crossroads of Russia, China, and Central Asia, and has large energy reserves with billions invested by American companies. Despite that wealth, many Kazakhs live in poverty. And as Nick Schifrin reports, economic frustrations are boiling over into demands to upend the country's authoritarian politics.
In western Kazakhstan, the protest became a revolt. Protesters chant Shal Ket, old man out, a reference to 81-year-old Nursultan Nazarbayev, who's helped lead Kazakhstan since independence 30 years ago, and is the symbol of a corrupt elite whom demonstrators tried to topple. They rallied to target a system they say enriches political cronies and neglects the people.
You have to understand what has happened here. The coiled spring has now been unleashed after 30 years.
Kazakhstan is wealthy, but technically it's listed as a lower middle-income country, and the actual day-to-day incomes of the majority of the population is really quite low.
Richard Hoagland is a former U.S. ambassador to Kazakhstan and is now at the Caspian Policy Institute.
Most of the money has gone into a very few pockets, and those tend to be the pockets of the oligarchs and the pockets of the Nazarbayev extended family.
Nazarbayev stepped down as president in 2019, but as the so-called father of the nation, installed current president Kasym-Jomart Tokayev as his successor. Tokayev recently increased the price of fuel, sparking protests in western Kazakhstan earlier this week. That ignited a political flame. In the cultural capital, Almaty, they stormed government buildings. By Thursday, the mayor's office and the presidential residence both burned out. Authorities turned violent. Police said they, quote, liquidated more than two dozen protesters. Over multiple days, demonstrators attacked police, burned police cars, and authorities say they killed more than 18 cops, at least one by beheading. President Tokayev called the protesters foreign terrorists, cut off the internet, and today told police to shoot to kill.
The militants have not laid down their arms. The fight against them must be pursued to the end. Whoever does not surrender will be destroyed.
And now, for the first time, an alliance of post-Soviet states deployed militarily, and Russian troops are in a neighbor considered the region's most stable country. Today, Secretary of State Antony Blinken questioned the need for Russia's presence.
Kazakh authorities and government certainly have the capacity to deal appropriately with protests, to do so in a way that respects the rights of protesters while maintaining law and order. Once Russians are in your house, it's sometimes very difficult to get them to leave.
Tokayev has maintained a partnership with the U.S., in part through American oil giants' presence in Kazakhstan's west. But Russia's influence is greater, and President Vladimir Putin's may increase with a Russian troop deployment, says Hoagland.
What he's probably doing is, in a way, making sure that a new Western-looking generation leadership does not come into power immediately in Kazakhstan, that it will stay with people who understand Russia, who are partners with Russia, and Russia gets a leg up that way.
And it looks like Kazakhstan's leaders will try to keep their power by targeting their own citizens. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Nick Schifrin.
As we end this week of remembrance of the attack on the Capitol, we return to some familiar faces, our own NewsHour correspondents who were on duty covering the events of January 6th. Lisa Desjardins, who was inside the Capitol, Amna Nawaz, who was outside the building as the crowd gathered, and Yamiche Alcindor, who was at the White House. The four of us spoke last year in the days following the insurrection for our podcast, America Interrupted. And when we came together again earlier this week, we talked about how the country has changed in the year since. Lisa, let me start with you. You were inside the Capitol. I remember it vividly as the rioters broke through the glass in those doors. You were eyewitness to the worst attack on the U.S. Capitol in 200 years. From a political standpoint, Lisa, it looks like a much more partisan place. What does it feel like from the inside?
I didn't think that the Capitol could get more partisan than after the 2020 election ended in 2020, but it has. And I also have to say, you know, a year ago, we all felt these palpable, very raw emotions from lawmakers right after January 6th, and I knew they would continue. I thought they would continue February, March, April. Democrats just seething with anger. Democrats who don't usually express this kind of anger were saying things like this to me, that they couldn't look at Republicans, couldn't even get in an elevator with some of the Republicans who had objected to the election. I was sure that that would wane by the end of the summer. And I have to say, it really didn't. It continued through the fall, as we saw some Republicans increase their rhetoric on the other side. I will say just this one holiday break, this past holiday break, I have sensed in my phone calls with lawmakers, finally a little bit of breathing and a little bit of relaxing of that anger. But I just don't know what's going to happen when they return to Washington.
Interesting. And Yamiche, you were at the White House. You were on the lawn as all this was unfolding at the Capitol. You were trying to stay in contact with then Trump administration officials on the inside. How has our understanding of what then President Trump was doing during all this, how has that evolved and changed over the last year?
Well, Judy, I do remember standing on the White House lawn and watching people break into the U.S. Capitol. The president was watching it all unfold on TV like so many other Americans, and he was in some ways both enjoying the idea that his supporters had taken his lie about the election being stolen so seriously that they were breaking into the Capitol to sort of defend his line, his idea of what should be happening in this moment. But he was also in some ways fearful because there was real violence happening. The president's lie has metastasized. It's grown all across the GOP. And now you have GOP lawmakers, elected officials who at first were outraged, who at first were telling me that the president had gone too far. They've now all sort of fallen in line. So the president, former president, has continued to lie about the election, continued to say that the election was stolen, and his power that seemed to be teetering, that seemed to be almost coming to an end on January 6th, it's only grown and grown.
And then, Amna, you were outside the Capitol. You were talking to the protesters and others outside, watching as all this unfolded. Recollect for us some of the language you were hearing from them and talk about how that's evolved in the years since.
You know, Judy, in terms of everyone we talked to outside that day, there was one thing everyone had in common, and that was that they believed the election lie. They believed that the election had been stolen. Beyond that, in terms of rhetoric, it was really a mishmash. I mean, there were conspiracy theorists out there waving QAnon flags. There were anti-vaxxers and COVID deniers who harassed me and our team for wearing masks out there. There were far-right extremists. There were white nationalists, white supremacists, openly wearing the insignias of these groups and walking around. And it was this overlapping, this sort of toxic brew of ideological beliefs and personal grievances that really caught a lot of people by surprise and caught a lot of national security and counterterrorism experts by surprise at the time, too. They hadn't seen it before. Well, how much has that changed in the years since? Not much. If anything, it's gotten worse. I mean, we know the potency of that election lie that millions of people still believe. We know where we are with anti-vaxxers and COVID deniers. And we also know where we are with the larger threat to the U.S. from some of those groups. Those blending of beliefs, experts say, is more volatile than ever. You know, the top two lethal threats, domestic threats to the U.S. today, are violent white supremacists and anti-government extremists. And those remain the top concerns for counterterrorism officials.
And in terms of holding people accountable, we've seen over 700 people arrested, charged in connection with the assault on the Capitol. Lisa, you have a firsthand connection with all of this. Two of the people who were following you inside the Capitol have been sentenced in the last week or so.
That's right. And you know, Judy, I didn't know that I was being followed until this summer when the Department of Justice contacted me and said, we see on video that two of the rioters followed you for a significant distance. Those two men from Pennsylvania, were just sentenced this week, and their attorneys were both asking that they be given no more than one day in jail. This was their first offense for both of them. Neither of them harmed anyone when they were in their building. They did pick up some papers, some congressional papers, at some point and put them down. And that is one of the things the judge said was serious. The judge did give them 30 days in jail, which was a disappointment to their attorneys. But the judge said, it is not enough to say that you just wandered into the building or you didn't mean to be there or you wished you could have left or that you regret it. The judge was very strong and said, this was an attack on our democracy, and I cannot condone this kind of mob violence.
Some of the language we heard from these rioters that day, clearly there were racist elements to it. Yamiche, we've talked over the past year about how that language has persisted and how it's played into what was already a fraught controversy, conflict in our nation, across our nation, over racial justice. How do you see that coming together a year later?
Well, a year later, the language that we saw used at this attack on the Capitol has sort of spread and deepened across our country. We've had seen really an evolving of the conversation on race, where we saw, of course, the murder of George Floyd and the swelling of this idea that America really needed to be better when it came to not only policing Americans, but also the way that we talk about justice and race. And there's been a big backlash to that movement. And what we've seen really is that January 6th was not the end of something, but it was really the beginning of this ugly phase. So we've really seen a lot of people, I think, twisting the idea of pushing for racial equality in this country and making excuses, frankly, for the people who broke into the Capitol. And that has been detrimental, I think, to our democracy. And that continues to be the case.
And Amna, I want you to pick up on that, because this notion of how we use language with racist overtones and just arguments over what word to use about what happened on January the 6th, the words to use, whether it's white supremacy, whether it's insurrection versus a coup, all of these things are have not only been, they've filtered out into the public discourse, but they're things that journalists have had to think about.
That's absolutely right, Judy. I think it's important to point out that some of those forces that we confronted face-to-face that day on the Capitol grounds have always represented some of the biggest threats to people of color and to marginalized people in this country. And it was a mostly white crowd who had openly talked about bringing violence to the Capitol that day, who authorities did not see as a threat, who felt entitled to storm a federal property and try to overturn a democratic process because they were angry. And I think we've all done this long enough to know what that response would have been if that had been a crowd of all Black people or all brown people or all Muslim people or all immigrants. And this kind of organized eruption really laid bare what so many of us have long known and lived, which is that white anger is seen differently here.
I want to close by asking each one of you to think about what stays with you, what sticks in your mind as you go back and you think about that day. Lisa?
I think one that stays with me, this is going to sound so corny, there are two things. It's just the walking away from the Capitol that night. It, you know, we were there till 3-4 in the morning for the election to finish, and it was so important for all of us to stay there. And I think of that image. Sorry. And it was just, I just have such faith in the Capitol. Sorry, I'm getting emotional.
1 year later.
I think I just had, it was just, it's a beautiful place. And I really, walking away from the Capitol that night, looking at it, I just remember that feeling of faith in our Constitution and in that building. And one more thing, someone loaned me a phone charger at a critical moment, and that is something I will always hold on to. It is my lucky phone charger.
And Yamiche, for you, what memory stays most with you?
The memory that sticks most with me watching the Capitol being attacked is that sense of entitlement that these white protesters had to break in. And I kept picturing what it might have been like had these people been the protesters that I covered so closely in Ferguson, the Black people that were demanding justice and police accountability. It's very easy to see those people being shot, frankly, dead on the steps of the Capitol if they were Black or brown or immigrants. And to see some of the white protesters walk away with their lives, I think it's something that sticks with me because to me it taught a lesson of who could be outraged, who could break into the Capitol and keep their lives, and who are the people who, if they stand peacefully on a street and demand justice, they might die just for asking peacefully for respect.
And finally, Amna, what stays with you?
Well, Judy, as you know, I spent years as a war correspondent, a conflict reporter overseas, parachuting in and out of places where, quite frankly, scenes like this were expected. And I said on the day, and it is still true, that I never expected to see that scene unfold in my own home country, but also on the steps of the U.S. Capitol. And I think what last year has shown me is that while America is absolutely unique as a nation with its democracy, it is not immune from a lot of those same forces that can wear away and tear away and eat away at foundational parts of our democracy. And that includes journalism, right? A free and fair press. So I think what I carry with me, what sticks with me, is really just this sense of duty to continue to not just report on everything we see and to bear witness, but also to remind people about what's at stake.
Well, the three of you were absolutely essential to the NewsHour's reporting on that historic, tragic and historic day in America. So we cannot thank you enough for what you did on that day and the reporting ever since, and of course, right up until right now. So I want to thank you, Lisa Desjardins, Amna Nawaz, and Yamiche Alcindor. This is your last program as a NewsHour correspondent, White House correspondent. You are leaving us to go on to NBC News. We wish you the very best. We're going to miss you. You've contributed so much to the work of this program. But we will miss you, and we thank you, all three.
Thank you so much, Judy. It's been an honor to work and report with you and so many others on this program.
Thank you. Thank you all. with the one-year anniversary of the Capitol insurrection, with a renewed push on voting rights, and with vaccine mandates getting their day in court, it has been a full week. To consider it all, we're joined by Brooks and Capehart, that is New York Times columnist David Brooks and Jonathan Capehart, columnist for The Washington Post. Very good to see both of you, even though you're not here in the studio. I was going to start with something else, but I have to begin with January the 6th, Jonathan, listening to what our correspondents were saying and thinking about what President Biden yesterday said, taking it right to his predecessor, saying that former President Trump was holding a dagger at the throat of our democracy. That's a stunning statement. What do we make of that?
It's a stunning statement, Judy, and it is a true statement. You know, the thing to keep in mind about President Biden is that he is, since the campaign, he has never been more clear, focused, direct, passionate, and determined than when he is talking about American democracy, or as he called it, the soul of America, and the damage and danger that Donald Trump was to both. He started his campaign in talking about Charlottesville and why that animated him to jump into the 2020 race. And then there in Statuary Hall as president of the United States, with, to his mind, the clear and present danger of Donald Trump and what he did as president and what he could do down the road if he decides to run for president in 2024. I think the president, after almost a year in office of getting some legislative wins under his belt, decided that the anniversary of the most dangerous moment in history for Congress, that that was the time to say clearly and forcefully that what happened in that building was a travesty, and that he's going to do everything that he possibly can to ensure that it doesn't happen again. And the first step in that is talking about it, naming names, and trying to hold them publicly accountable for what they did.
And David, what do you make of the of President Biden using this stark imagery, hold a dagger?
Yeah, I thought the president was right to not talk about Trump directly for most of this past year, because there was the hope that Trump would fade away. And I must say, on January 7th of last year, I thought what the events of January 6th were so horrific and so disgusting that it would be an inflection point and people would look at the whole Trump era as something lamentable and terrible. I was wrong about that. Donald Trump has not faded away. He's, if anything, stronger in the Republican Party. So if Donald Trump's not going to fade away, you might as well tell the truth. And you might as well go after him directly. And you might as well go after him with the passion of a man who worked for 30 years, more than 30 years, in that building, and who mentioned yesterday that the rotunda where they were sitting, that's where Abraham Lincoln sat. That's, you know, a few feet down the hallway, there's John F. Kennedy. A few feet down the other hallway, there's Tip O'Neill. And so this is American history that was trampled, something Joe Biden has devoted his life to extending and making prosperous. So there's got to be strong emotions there, and I'm glad he expressed them.
And Jonathan, I mean, as you're pointing out, as David's pointing out, this is a turn for President Biden. He hasn't wanted or hasn't spent a lot of time talking directly about the former president, but now he's going after him. Is there a risk in that?
There are risks in everything, but I think that the president and the White House have made the calculation that if you're going to take any kind of risk, if the risk is in defending American democracy, then it is a risk worth taking. And I think that the president, the speech yesterday was terrific. It was what the nation needed to hear, but it can't be the last step. It has to be the first step of many to remind people about what happened, who did it, and also to remind people that even though the focus right now is on Donald Trump, what Donald Trump unleashed will survive Donald Trump, whether he runs for president or not. And that is the big danger that I think a lot of people are might be getting themselves into by focusing so intensely on Donald Trump and the damage he did to this country, that they're maybe not paying attention to the forces that he unleashed that can't be put back in the bottle now that they have been unleashed.
David, pick up on that. I mean, how is it a gamble for President Biden to be taking this tack right now in his presidency?
I don't think so. The Democrats criticizing Donald Trump is not exactly a new thing. It's not exactly a risky thing for Democrats. To take it down a notch to the crass political level, the Democrats are going to try to keep that their majorities in 2022. Joe Biden presumably is going to try to keep the presidency, or at least have a Democrat in the presidency in 2024. His approval ratings are not high enough to do that on the basis of his own accomplishments. And frankly, he didn't win the presidency the first time because people love Joe Biden. That he won it because people really dislike Donald Trump. And so raising the saliency of Trump is probably the smart thing to do. Now, there are clear limits to that, as we learned in the Virginia gubernatorial race, when the Democrats tried to tie Youngkin to Trump, and it didn't work. So I don't think it's the only thing he can do to keep Democrats in office, but it's certainly a key part of it.
Well, one of the things we're seeing the president and the vice president do, they're heading to Atlanta, Jonathan, next week to make what they're calling major speech or statement on voting rights, a big push for legislation that they have not been able to get through Congress. Meantime, some Republicans, and I know you all talked about this a little bit last week, but meantime, Republicans are coming back and saying, well, let's look at electoral vote count reform. I asked Vice President Harris about that when I had a chance to talk to her yesterday. Here's what she had to say about how to think about these two things.
It's not a solution to the problem at hand, which is that right now in the United States of America, we need federal laws that guarantee the freedom and right of every American to have access to the ballot, to be able to vote. The John Lewis Voting Rights Act, the Freedom to Vote Act, address that issue. And those are the issues that are present and that are imminent.
So, Jonathan, she's saying voting rights has to come before anything with the electoral vote count.
Well, because as she was saying, what is happening in the states is happening because of the big lie, suppressing the vote, keeping people from voting. And also now the prospect of once people have voted, boards of elections that have now been taken over by state legislatures having their votes tossed out. So that's why there's such there's this big push for the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act to be passed, for the Freedom to Vote Act to be passed. But I also think in your interview with the vice president, I think she goes on to say that it's not an either or. Both of these things have to be done. It's a matter of priority. And when it comes to the Electoral Count, the Electoral Count Act, you know, Congressman Jamie Raskin, who's a member of the January 6th Select Committee, writes in his new book, Unthinkable, about how they saw months, by May of 2020, that the Electoral Count Act was probably the way that Donald Trump was going to try to mess with the election because it was so squishy. So the Electoral Count Act must be reformed, but doing that instead of passing the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act or the Freedom to Vote Act, that's not a solution to the near-term danger that faces the right to vote right now.
How do you, David, how do you see movement on these two things or not?
Well, I think we probably need to do both, but I really do think the Democrats have to completely revamp their approach to the national emergency January 6th started, or Donald Trump started and is continuing expanding right to this day. There are sort of three elements to an election. There's casting the votes, there's counting the votes, and then there's certifying the results. We do not have a crisis in casting the votes. We just in 2020 had the highest vote turnout in American history. We don't have at all a problem in counting the votes. We counted the votes without fraud and without error pretty much in 2020, as we've seen. We have a complete crisis in the certification of the votes. It's that third thing where we have this complete crisis where state legislatures are politicizing the vote certification, where they're attacking the people who bravely stood up to Donald Trump, where Republicans are running for these local judge of elections positions, Republicans who are Trumpy and presumably use them for nefarious ends. And so we have this massive assault on our democracy in the certification of the results. The problem with the Freedom to Vote Act is it has very little about that. It's all about elements one and two. And so to me, what the Democrats need to do is really focus on the certification. protecting the people who are nonpartisan and certifying results. The Democrats need to get much more active locally on these local races for judge of elections and all those other things. And they're not doing that. The Republicans are far outpacing them on the ground and on the grassroots. And so, me, the House is on fire on that. And so we should be focusing on that and take care of that immediately. And then we can do the other voting rights, which are very hard to pass. We can do it now or we can do it later. But we need to focus on that third thing.
Jonathan, what about that?
I agree with David that the House is on fire. But I don't agree with David. And David mentions this, has mentioned this at least three times about how there's no, you know, the vote is not being suppressed. There are a lot of Democratic and progressive activists and actual voters who would disagree with that, especially those who are standing in line for hours and hours in multiple locations, multiple states in order to vote. But look, all of these things that we are talking about need to be addressed. The only problem is we don't live in a monarchy and we don't live in a dictatorship where, you know, President Biden, King Biden, Dictator Biden can just go and say, this shall be done. What the Senate needs to do is to take action to ensure that whoever wants to register to vote can vote, that the person who registers to vote is able to vote as conveniently as possible. And then when that person does vote, that their vote actually gets counted and that their voice is actually heard by not having a state board overturn the voice of the people, the will of the people at the ballot box. That has to be done. And that can only be done at this point if the United States Senate rallies around and gets it done. But unfortunately, we spend a lot of our time talking about two senators, one in particular, who still, even though the House is on fire, is refusing to be a part of the solution to put the fire out.
David, put the button on this. Why isn't that the priority? You've got 30 seconds.
I don't think the answer is in Washington. Democrats need to rally people in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, and state capitals around the country. They need to work on state legislators. They may need to make it extremely painful for anybody to vote to politicize the certification of a result. I think the focus on Washington is the wrong focus right now. And the Republicans know this, and they're doing something about it, and Democrats are not.
Clarion call from each one of you, David Brooks and Jonathan Capehart. Thank you both on this Friday night. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Judy.
Thank you, Judy.
As we reported tonight, Oscar-winning actor Sidney Poitier has died at the age of 94. Throughout his life, the star carved a path for generations of Black actors to come. Jeff Bennett has our remembrance.
Sidney Poitier transformed how Black characters were portrayed on screen and became the first Black actor to win an Academy Award for Best Lead Performance. For more on his life, I'm joined by Jacqueline Stewart, the Chief Artistic and Programming Officer for the New Academy Museum of Motion Pictures in Los Angeles. She's a professor of film and media studies at the University of Chicago and host of Silent Sunday Nights on Turner Classic Movies. It's great to have you with us. And Sidney Poitier was dignified, he was elegant, he was regal, he was known for playing characters who really jumped off the screen. But before we talk about his cinematic and cultural legacies, help us understand his journey to stardom. He was born in the Bahamas before moving to Harlem and facing the sort of hardscrabble life of an actor.
No, that's absolutely right. He really did struggle to become an actor. It wasn't something that was obvious given his impoverished background in the Bahamas. It's really, I think, gratifying to see the ways that he took all of those hardships that he faced, really working odd jobs in New York, trying to figure out a way that he was going to achieve his professional vision. And it's a really miraculous story just at the level of how he entered the theater and then became such an important film star.
Poitier was the embodiment of a proud and dignified Black perspective in the American conversation about race during the Civil Rights Movement. And by 1967, as you know, he was Hollywood's top earning leading man. He played a Philadelphia detective fighting bigotry in Mississippi. He played Virgil Tibbs in The Heat of the Night, a man righteous enough to slap in return the white politician who had slapped him. Take a look at this.
Was Mr. Colbert ever in this greenhouse, say, last night about midnight?
Gillespie?
Yeah.
You saw it.
I saw it.
What are you going to do about it? I don't know.
So how did that resonate in the moment? A black man slapping back the white man who slapped him?
Ooh, it was an incredibly powerful moment. And I would say it was an important moment, not just for white audiences, but for black audiences as well. One of the things I think is so important about that scene is that we see Gillespie, Rod Steiger's reaction to the slap, his visual reaction, and then his expression, I don't know what to do. It's a moment where white supremacy is being questioned and challenged. And that was tremendously significant to people. This idea that, I think so for so many folks, people think of Sidney Poitier as this sort of harbinger of a kind of assimilationist or accommodationist point of view. But that scene demonstrates that he was also someone who was representing this this fury that was raging in so many black communities and this tipping point that we're not going to take it anymore. And so that was hugely important to audiences across the racial spectrum.
And then there was his role in Guess Who's Coming to Dinner as Dr. John Prentice. He was half of this interracial couple, and he had to tell his disapproving father that times had really changed.
I'm your son. I love you. But you think of yourself as a colored man. I think of myself as a man.
And I want to ask you more about the scrutiny he faced, because Poitier was often hailed as this noble symbol of his race who took these sanitized roles, which drew criticism from some that he took these roles that in many ways were pandering to white audiences. You hear him say there, I don't think of myself as a colored man. There are of lots of black folks who would say, you know, that is a choice not available to many.
That's right. Yeah, I think what's important is to really look at more nuanced aspects of what Poitier was doing across his career. He was so selective with the roles that he took. He understood the limitations of what was possible for black actors in Hollywood during that time. And it seems to me that he was always trying to squeeze out as much, the word you used a lot, dignity and respect, and adding aspects to these performances that I don't think many audiences really understood, whether they were championing him or criticizing him. So when he says, you think of yourself as a colored man, that's a generational thing that he's pointing to in that speech, that his father is from an older time. He's not saying that I'm not a black man, which is not the same thing as being a colored man. I think that part of what the point of that scene is opening up a space for black people to think about themselves in ways beyond the white limitations that have been placed on them. And I think now when we look back at a scene like that, we can see that there's something much more complex going on than, say, some simple rejection of his racial identity.
How would you capture his contributions to the culture?
He was hugely influential. I mean, this is an actor who really changed the minds of many white people about black people, of seeing black people as complex human beings. And he also was a figure who paved the way for so many generations of black actors to follow. There were very few models for him, but he has been the model for Denzel Washington and so many others who have followed.
Jacqueline Stewart, thanks so much for joining us as we remember the life and many contributions of Sidney Poitier.
My pleasure.
Sidney Poitier, no one like him. And that is the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Judy Woodruff. Join us online and again here on Monday evening. For all of us at the PBS NewsHour, thank you. Please stay safe and have a good weekend.